Hello everyone, I'm Jörg Heise from Fries Magazine, and I'm very happy and proud to be able to welcome Boris Groys, who has been a leading intellectual, critic, philosopher in Russia since the 1970s, in Europe and around the world. Boris Groys is professor of philosophy and art theory at the Academy of Design in Karlsruhe, Germany, and he's also a global professor at New York University. He has been the curator of such influential exhibitions as Dream Factory, Communism, and more recently, Total Enlightenment, Moscow Conceptual Art, 1960 to 1990, both exhibitions at Kunsthalle in Frankfurt, 2003 and 2008, respectively. Boris Groys is also the author of many books, including The Art of Stalinism and Ilya Kabakov, published in 2006, and more recently, His recent collection of essays, Art Power, has been described by Brian Dillon in September's issue of Fries as, I quote, "buzzling with usefully sly and counterintuitive propositions," unquote. So please welcome Boris Groys and the counterintuitive propositions he will certainly present us with. Thank you.
Thank you, Jörg. I'm glad to be here, and I start. Nowadays, almost everybody seems to agree that the times are over in which art, successfully or unsuccessfully, tried to establish its autonomy. At the same time, this diagnosis is accompanied by mixed feelings. One tends to celebrate the readiness of contemporary art to transcend traditional borders of the art system if such a move is dictated by a will to change the dominating social and political conditions to make the world a better place. Or in other words, if the act of overcoming the borders of the art system is ethically motivated. However, one tends to deplore an indisputable fact that such an attempt to transcend the art system seems never to lead beyond the aesthetical sphere in general. Instead of changing the world, art only makes it to look better. This causes a lot of frustration inside the art system, so that the dominating mood of the art scene seems almost permanently to shift back and forth between hopes to intervene into the world beyond art and disappointment and even despair because of impossibility to achieve this goal. This failure is often interpreted as a proof of incapacity of art to penetrate the political sphere per se. But I would rather argue that if the politicization of art is seriously intended and practiced, it mostly succeeds. Art can enter the political sphere, and indeed, art entered it already many times in the 20th century. The problem is not the incapacity of art to become truly political. The problem is that today's political sphere became already aestheticized. When art becomes political, it has to make an unpleasant discovery that politics already became art, that politics already situated itself in the aesthetic field. In our time, every politician, sport hero, terrorist, or movie star are generating a great amount of images because their activities are automatically covered by the media. Earlier, the division of labor between politics and art was quite clear. The politician made the politics, and the artist represented this politics, but narrating it or depicting it or make advertisement for it. The voice of the other. But in our time, the situation has changed drastically. The contemporary politician does not need an artist anymore to get fame and to inscribe his action into the universal memory. Every important political figure or event is immediately registered, represented, described, depicted, narrated, and interpreted by the media. The machine of the media coverage does not need any individual artistic intervention, any individual artistic decision to be put into motion. Indeed, the contemporary mass media has emerged as by far the largest and most powerful machine for producing images, vastly more extensive and effective than the contemporary art system. We are constantly fed with images of war, terror, and catastrophes of all kinds at a level of image production and distribution with which the artist, with his artisan skills, cannot compete. Now, if an artist goes beyond the art system, this artist begins to function in the same way as politicians, sport heroes, terrorists, movie stars, and other major and minor celebrities already function. So the artist becomes a celebrity, in fact. And that means the artist also becomes to be covered by the media. Or in other words, the artist becomes the artwork. The transition from the art system to the political field is possible. But this transition operates today primarily as a change in the positioning of the artist vis-à-vis the image production. The artist ceases to be an image producer and becomes an image instead. Already Friedrich Nietzsche registered this transformation and famously said that it's actually better to be an artwork than to be an artist in his Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music. But becoming an artwork provokes, of course, not only a pleasure, but also an anxiety of being subjected in a very radical way to the gaze of the other, namely, in that case, to the gaze of the media functioning as a super artist. I would characterize this anxiety as an anxiety of self-design, because this anxiety forces the artist, as almost everybody who becomes, to be subjected to the media coverage, to deal with the image of the self, to correct, to change, to adapt, to redesign, to contradict it. One can often hear today that art of our time is functioning more and more as design. That is, of course, true, if only to a certain extent. But the ultimate problem of design is not how I design the world outside myself, but how I design myself, or rather, how I deal with the way in which the world designs me. And today it becomes a general, all-pervasive problem, and problem with which everybody is confronted, not only politicians, movie stars, and other celebrities. Today everybody is subjected to an aesthetic evaluation and is required to take an aesthetic responsibility for his or her appearance in the world, on the different levels of this appearance, for his or her self-design. In early days, self-design was a privilege and a burden of the chosen few. In our time, self-design became the mass culture practice par excellence. The virtual space of the internet is primarily an arena on which my face and my space are permanently designed and redesigned to be presented to YouTube, and vice versa. But also in the real, or let's say analog world, one is expected to be responsible for the image that he or she presents to the gaze of the others. One can say that self-design is a practice that does unite artists and his audience in the most radical way, because not everybody produces artworks, but everybody is becoming an artwork today, and at the same time is supposed to be its author. Now, every kind of design, including self-design, is mostly regarded and must be regarded as a way not to reveal things, or let's say, not only to reveal things that are designed, but rather to cover them. Actually, already this a word, media coverage, is very telling in this sense. So media coverage means that some things are becoming visible through media. At the same time, they are covered by media, so actually concealed by media. Aestheticization of the politics is also interpreted as a way to substitute substance by looks and real issues by superficial image making. But the issues are changing all the time, and the image remains. One can easily become a prisoner of his image, and one's political convictions can be easily ridiculed as being only a part of one's self-design. Aestheticization is often identified with seduction and celebration. That is the meaning of the word aestheticization that Walter Benjamin has obviously in mind, as he constructed at the end of his famous essay on the work in the age of its mechanical reproduction, the opposition between politicization of aesthetics and aestheticization of politics. Aestheticization of politics actually associated with fascism. But one can argue, on the contrary, that every act of aestheticization is always already a critique of the object of this aestheticization, because it signals that this object needs a supplement to look better as it actually is. And such a supplement is always functioning as a pharmacon, in a sense in which Jacques Derrida has used this term. Design makes a designed object look better, but at the same time, it raises a suspicion that this object would look especially ugly and repellent if its design surface would be accidentally removed. Indeed, the design, including self-design, is primarily a machine for production of suspicion. Contemporary thoughtfully designed world is often described as a world of seduction, of spectacle, from which the unpleasant reality disappeared. But actually, the world of total design is a world of total suspicion, of latent danger lurking behind the design surfaces. So the main goal of the self-design is neutralization of suspicion on the side of a possible spectator, or creation of the sincerity effect that provokes trust in the spectator's soul. The production of sincerity and trust is everybody's occupation in today's world, is occupation of politics in the first place, and also financial markets, as we know. But at the same time, it was and still is the main occupation of art throughout the whole history of modernity. The modern artist has always positioned himself or herself as the only one honest person in the world of hypocrisy and corruption. Let us shortly investigate how the production of sincerity and trust has functioned in the period of modernity, because it will make easier to characterize the way in which it functions today. One can argue that modern production of sincerity functioned as a reduction of design. The goal was to create blank, void space in the middle of the designed world, to eliminate design, to practice zero design. Adolf Loos's famous essay, Ornament and Crime, from 1908, is an early example of this turn to the zero design, to the design as elimination of design, anti-design. From the outset, Loos postulated in his essay a unity between the aesthetics and the ethical. That is why Loos condemned every decoration, every ornament, as a sign of depravity, of vice. Namely, Loos saw a person's appearance to be an immediate expression of his or her ethical stance. And if he could identify in a person's appearance the wish to cover itself by design, he rejected this person as being ethically deficient, actually a bad person. For example, Loos asserted that only criminals, primitive or degenerates, ornament themselves by tattooing the skin. Ornament was thus an expression either of immorality or of crime. I quote, "The Papuan covers his skin with tattoos, his boat, his oars. In short, everything he can lay his hands on. He is not a criminal. The modern person who tattoos himself is either a criminal or degenerate. The particularly striking thing about this quotation is that laws makes no distinction between tattooing one on skin and decorating a boat. Just as a modern human being is supposed to present him or herself to the gaze of the other as a honest, plain, unornamented, undesigned object, so should all the other things with which this person has to deal be presented also as honest, plain, undesigned things. Only then do they demonstrate that the soul of the person using them is pure, virtuous, unspoiled. For laws, true design is a struggle against design. And he speaks about this zero design in an almost apocalyptic way. Laws writes in his essay, I quote again, "Do not weep. Do you not see the greatness of our age resides in our very inability to create new ornament? We have gone beyond ornament. We have achieved plain, undecorated simplicity. Behold, the time is at hand. Fulfillment awaits us. Soon the streets of the cities will shine like white walls, like Zion, the holy city, heaven's capital. Then fulfillment will be ours." End of quotation. The struggle against design is a final struggle before the arrival of God's kingdom on earth. The modern designer does not wait for the end of times to remove the external shell of things and show them as they are. The soul becomes a body. All things become heavenly. Heaven becomes earthly, material. Design becomes absolute and identical with the things themselves. That is a modern claim. And that is a modern requirement directed to the design, an absolute, earnest, ethically motivated attitude. Whereas Lowes still formulated his argument in a rather bourgeois terms and wanted to reveal the value of certain materials, craft, work, and individual honesty, the view to absolute design and absolutely honest design reached its climax in Russian constructivism with its proletarian ideal of the collective soul, which is manifested in industrially organized work. For the Russian constructivist, the path to the virtuous, genuinely proletarian things also passed through the elimination of everything that was merely artistic. The Russian constructivist called for the things of everyday communist life to show themselves as what they are. And in this sense, the experience of October Revolution of 1917 became crucial for the Russian constructivism. Actually, in many writings of that time, we can read that the October Revolution, communist revolution, is the most interesting and best example of contemporary design. They understood the revolution to be a radical act of purifying society of every form of ornament. The finest example of modest design, which eliminates all traditional social customs, ritual, conventions, and forms of representation in order to permit the essence of the political organization to emerge and to become visible. That the Russian constructivist called for the abolition of all autonomous art. And at the same time, the project of design was a total one. In fact, the communist self-design was crucial for the self-identification of the Soviet society. Indeed, the body of the technique that was used by the bourgeois society of the West was actually the same as one used by the Soviet power. Therefore, the difference between capitalism and socialism could be made visible only by the means of design. That's very interesting discussion at the time of the 20s. How to define the difference between capitalism and socialism? And the answer was through design, because there are no other means to do so. By the Rousseauistic phase into the equation between sincerity and zero design disappeared in our time. Nobody is ready now to believe anymore that the minimalist design would suggest that the subject of this design is necessarily honest and sincere. The avant-garde design of honesty and trust has thus become a specific designer style among other possible styles. Under this condition, the only way to create an effect of sincerity is not to refute the initial suspicion, but to confirm it. Or to say it another way, we are ready to believe that the crack in the, we are ready to believe that the crack in the design surface has already took place, and that we have really got a chance to see things as they truly are, only if the reality behind the facade shows itself as being much, much worse than we ever assumed it to be. So if it exceeds all our worst expectations and suspicions. Being confronted with a totally designed world, we can accept only absolute catastrophe, a state of emergency, a violent rupture of the surface as an event that allows us to take a look behind design surface. And of course, the reality that we look at has to show itself as also being a catastrophic reality. All the time we suspect that something terrible is going on behind design, cynical manipulation, political propaganda, hidden intrigues, invested interest, simply crimes. The conspiracy theory is the only form in which the traditional metaphysics survived after the death of God, as a discourse about the hidden and invisible. Earlier, we had nature, so physics, and God, so metaphysics. Today we have design and conspiracy theory. If you look at the conspiracy theory, it's theology and metaphysics of our contemporary world. It is not an actually art world loves conspiracy theories. It is not an accident that even if we are generally inclined to distrust the media, we are immediately ready to believe it when it tells it about a global financial crisis or deliver into our apartments the images of September 11. Even the most committed theorists of the postmodern simulation, like Baudrillard, began to speak about the return of the real as they saw the images of September 11. Now, there is an old tradition of Western art also to present an artist as a walking catastrophe. And the modern artists, at least from Baudelaire on, were always good at creating the images of evil lurking behind the surface, the images that immediately won the trust of the public. In our days, the romantic image of poet Maudit, or artist Maudit, is substituted by an image of the artist being explicitly cynical, greedy, manipulative, business-oriented, seeking only the material profit, and interpreting art as a machine for deceiving the audience. We have learned the strategy of calculated self-denunciation, or better to say, of self-denunciatory self-design, on the example of Salvador Dali and Andy Warhol, up to Jeff Koons on Damien Hirst. This strategy, even if being old enough, has almost never missed its goal. Looking at the public image of this artist and comparable artist, we tend to think, oh, how awful, how terrible. But at the same time, oh, how true and how sincere. The self-design as self-denunciation, so to think, to show how bad I am, actually. The self-design as self-denunciation is still working in a time in which the avant-garde design of honesty fails. In fact, contemporary art shows here how the whole celebrity culture works, namely through disclosures and self-disclosures. Celebrities, including politicians, are presented to the contemporary audience as design surfaces. Accordingly, the reaction of the public to them takes the form of suspicion and conspiracy theory. Just to make the politicians look trustworthy, one has to create a moment of disclosure, a chance to look through the surface. Then everybody thinks, oh, this politician is as bad as I always supposed him to be. In this way, the trust in the system is restored. Here we have a ritual of symbolic sacrifice and self-sacrifice that stabilizes the celebrity system by confirming the suspicion to which the system is necessarily subjected. And of course, according to the economy of symbolic exchange that was investigated by Marcel Mauss and Georges Bataille, the individuals that show themselves as being especially bad and mean, that means the individuals that bring the most substantial symbolic sacrifice, get the most recognition and fame. This fact alone shows that also here we have to do not with a true insight, but with a special case of self-design. To present himself or herself as ethically bad and catastrophically bad means today to make especially good self-design in aesthetic terms. If somebody comes to you and says, I'm a genius, artistic genius, you say, oh, so hypocritical, pretentious. But if somebody takes, I'm a swine, and say, oh, yes, it's true, but you are a swine, but at least honest. But there's also a more subtle, a more sophisticated way of self-design and self-sacrifice, namely self-design a symbolic suicide. Following this more subtle strategy of self-design, the artist announces, together with writer and philosopher, the death of the author. That means his or her own symbolic death. In this case, the artist proclaims himself not to be bad, but to be dead. And the resulting artwork is presented as being collaborative, participative, and democratic. A tendency toward collaborative participatory practice is undeniably one of the main characteristics of contemporary art. Emerging throughout the world are numerous artist groups that assert collective, even anonymous authorship of their artistic production. Moreover, collaborative practices of this type tend to motivate the public to join in, to activate the social milieu in which this practice is involved. But the self-sacrifice of the individual authorship also gets compensated in terms of symbolic economy of recognition and fame. The modern state of art affairs can be described easily enough. The artist produces and exhibits art, and the public views and evaluates what is exhibited. This arrangement would seem primarily to benefit the artist, who shows himself to be an active individual in opposition to a passive, anonymous mass audience. The artist has the power to popularize his or her name, whereas the identities of the viewers remain unknown, despite the fact that the validation has facilitated the artist's success. Modern art can thus easily be misconstrued as an apparatus for manufacturing artistic celebrity at the expense of the public. However, what is often overlooked is the fact that in the modernity, the artist was delivered at the mercy, and is still delivered, at the mercy of the public's opinion. If an artwork does not find favor with the public, then it is de facto devoid of value. This is a modern art's main deficit. The modern artwork has no inner, non-aesthetic value of its own. It has no merit other than the public taste bestows upon it. The statues in ancient temples were regarded as embodiments of gods. They were revered. One kneeled down before them in prayer. One expected help for them and feared them. Under this condition, the aesthetic disapproval was insufficient reason to reject an artwork. Poorly made idols and badly painted icons were nevertheless part of the sacred order. And actually, it was already noted many times by art historians that really revered icons were all actually poorly painted. Throwing them out would have been sacrilegious. Thus, within a specific religious tradition, artworks have their own individual inner value, which is independent of the public aesthetic judgment. This value derives from the participation of the artist and his public in communal religious practices, an affiliation that relativizes the gulf between the artist and public that emerged in the modernity. By contrast, the secularization of art entails this radical devaluation. That is why Hegel asserted just at the beginning of his lectures on aesthetics that art was already there at the beginning of the 19th century, a thing of the past. No modern artist could expect anyone to kneel in front of his or her work in prayer, expect practical assistance from it, or use it to avert danger. The most one is prepared to do nowadays is to find an artwork interesting, and of course ask how much it costs. Now, price immunizes the artwork from public taste to a certain degree. A good deal of the art held in the museums today would have ended up in the trash a long time ago had the immediate effect of public taste not been limited by economic considerations. Communal participation in the same economical practice weakens the radical separation between the artist and his audience, creates certain complicity between artist and public, and forces the public to respect an artwork because of this high price, even if this artwork is not particularly liked. However, there is a big difference between the religious and financial value of an artwork. The price of an artwork is nothing other than the quite a quantifiable result of aesthetic value that others have identified in it. But the public taste is not binding for an individual in the same way in this common religious is. For this reason, many modern artists have tried to regain common ground with the audiences by enticing viewers out of their passive roles, bridging the comfortable aesthetic distance that allows uninvolved viewers to judge an artwork impartially from a secure external perspective. The majority of these attempts have involved political or ideological engagement on one sort or another. Religious community is thus replaced by a political movement in which artists and the audiences both participate. When the viewer is involved in artistic practice from the outset and shares also the political convictions of the artist, every piece of criticism he utters is a kind of self-criticism. Shared political attitudes and convictions make the aesthetical judgment partially or completely irrelevant, as it was the case with sacral art of the past. To put it bluntly, it is better to be a dead author than a bad author. The decision on the part of the artist to relinquish his or her exclusive authorship would seem primarily to empower the viewer. However, this sacrifice ultimately benefits the artist, for it frees him from the power that the cold eye of uninvolved viewer exerts over the resulting artwork. Today's artistic installation is often viewed as an art form that allows the artist to democratize his and her art, to take the public responsibility, to begin to act in the name of a certain community or even of the society as a whole. In this sense, the emergence of artistic installation seems to mark the end of the modernist claim of autonomy and sovereignty. The decision of the artist to let the multitude of visitors to enter the space of his or her artwork and to allow them to move freely inside it can and must be interpreted as the opening of the closed space of an artwork to democracy. This closed artwork space seems to be transformed in a platform for public discussion, democratic practice, communication, networking, education, etc. But this analysis of the installation art practice tends to overlook the act of symbolic privatization of the public space by the artistic installation that precedes the act of the opening of the installation space to a community of visitors. The space of the traditional exhibition is a symbolic public property, and the curator who manages the space acts in the name of the public opinion. The visitor of a standard exhibition remains all the time on his or her own territory. The visitor is a symbolic owner of the space where all the artworks are exposed, delivered to his gaze and judgment. On the contrary, the space of the artistic installation is a symbolic private property of the artist. Entering the installation space, the visitor leaves the public territory of democratic legitimacy and enters the space as sovereign, authoritarian control. The visitor is here, so to say, on the foreign territory, in exile. The visitor of the installation space becomes an expatriate who has to submit himself to a foreign law, to a law that is given to him by the artist. Here the artist acts as a legislator, as a sovereign of the installation space, even, and maybe especially so, if the law that is given by the artist to a community of visitors is a democratic law. One can say that the installation practice reveals the act of unconditional, sovereign violence that initially installs any democratic order. That means a kind of catastrophe behind the transparent design of contemporary democracy. We know that the democratic order was never brought about in a democratic fashion. The democratic order does always emerge as an effect of a violent revolution. To install a law means to break one. The first legislator can never act in a legitimate manner. The legislator installs a political order, but he does not belong to this order, remains external to this order, even if he decides later to submit himself to this order. The author of an artistic installation, even if this author is not also in a traditional sense of this word, is such a legislator that gives to the community of visitors a space to constitute itself and defines the rules to which this community has to submit, but does not belong to this community, remains outside of it. And that remains true even if the artist decides to join the community that he or she has created. The second step should not let us overlook the first one, the sovereign one. And one should also not forget, after initiating a certain order, a certain politeia, a certain community of the visitors, the installation artist has to rely on the art institutions to maintain this order, to police the fluid politeia of the installation visitors. And it should also be no illusion that it can be something like completely chaotic, dadaistic, fluxus-like installation space free of any control. In his famous treatise, Français encore une fois, si vous voulez être républicain, French another effort, if you want to be really a Republican, Marquis de Sade presents a vision of a perfectly free society that abolished all the laws and installed only one law, a perfect installation, so to say. Everybody has to do what he or she does like, including committing crimes of any kind. Now it is especially interesting that the Sartre states at the same time the necessity of the law enforcement that has to prevent the reactionary attempts of some traditionally thinking citizens to return to the old repressive state in which family is secured and crimes forbidden. So we need the police also to defend the crime against the reaction and nostalgia of the old moral order. That is, in fact, the function of the art system in general. The turn that laws announced in his day has proved to be irreversible. Every citizen of the contemporary world still has to take aesthetic responsibility for his or her self-design, as honest, as bad, or as dead. In a society in which design has taken over the function of religion, self-design becomes a creed. By designing oneself and one's environment in a certain way, one declares one faith in certain values, attitudes, programs, and ideologies. In accordance with this creed, one is judged by society, and the judgment can certainly be negative and even threaten the life and well-being of the person concerned. Actually, the contemporary function of design reminds me of discussions among Byzantine theologians concerning the question why the saints should be presented on the icons, Christian icons, wearing clothes and not naked as they present themselves to the eyes of God. The answer was, we as mortals, as God can't do that, but we as mortals can recognize the soul of a person only looking at his and her garments, because all naked bodies are alike. The differences on the level of the inner self, of the soul, can be made visible only through the differences in clothes, in fashion, in design. Thus, in fact, the body does not contain the soul. It is covered by the soul taking form of clothes. The soul is design. Thus, modern and contemporary design evades Kant's famous distinction between disinterested aesthetic contemplation and the use of things guided by interest. For a very long time before and after Kant, disinterested contemplation was considered superior to a practical attitude, a higher, if not the highest, manifestation of the human spirit. But already by the end of the 19th century, a reevaluation of values had taken place. The vita contemplativa was thoroughly discredited, and the vita activa was elevated to the true task of humankind. Hence, today, design is often accused of seducing people into weakening their activity, vitality, and energy. It is an argument by Deborah, of course, of making them passive consumers who lack will, who are manipulated by omnipresent advertising and thus become victims of capital. The cure for this lulling into sleep by the society of the spectacle is envisaged as a shock-like encounter with the real, real with big R, that is supposed to rescue people from their contemplative passivity and to move them to action, which is the only way to experience the truth as living intensity. The debate seems to be only over the question whether such an encounter with the real is still possible, or whether the real has definitively disappeared behind the design surface. Now, however, we can no longer speak of disinterested contemplation when it is a matter of self-manifestation, self-design, and self-positioning in the artistic field. Since the subject of self-contemplation clearly has a vital interest in the image he or she offers to the outside world. Once people had an interest in how their souls appeared to God, today they have an interest in how their bodies appear to be positioned in aesthetic and political space. This interest certainly points to the real. The real, however, emerges here not as a shock-like interruption of the design surface, but as technique and practice of self-design, a practice no one can escape anymore. In his days, Beuys said that everyone has a right to see himself or herself as an artist. Yeah? Everybody has to become an artist. But what then understood as a right has now become an obligation. In the meanwhile, we have all been condemned to be artists, to be designer of ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this inspiring talk full of ideas, and I hope you're full of questions now, and please don't hesitate to formulate them. Any initial questions?
Too full of ideas.
Well, I can maybe make a first question. You've discussed the question of design very much in relation also to the question basically of salvation and the soul, starting from Adolf Loos, whose writing presented almost the eradication of the ornamentation as an ultimate salvation and resolution. Whereas with Adolf Loos, it's quite obvious how he kind of makes that the issue of the function disappear against this question of form as salvation. I wonder how that happens in a more contemporary context, where I think the question of the function is still very prevalent for design.
Well, it is probably obvious the initial impulse to write this text came actually from Guy Debord, yeah, and from this idea of society of spectacle, yeah, so it is still kind of haunting contemporary imagination, I would say. And reading Debord and reading many other theorists and artists thinking and writing in this tradition, I ask myself, who is actually spectator of this spectacle Yeah? But if we say that whole society, whole world is a spectacle, yeah? Who is a spectator? It can be only God, yeah? But God is dead, and also Gideborg also committed suicide. Probably he was the last spectator, yeah? But now who is spectator? There's no spectator anymore. So the problem is that we have a stage, but we have a stage that everybody has to be on. Yeah? Now, salvation is survival today. Yeah? And so I tried to delineate at least two ways how to survive on the stage. Yeah? One possibility is to present something catastrophic and terrible because it is something that people believe into, or maybe to say you are bad, you are manipulative, and so on and so on. Yeah, so to be a catastrophe on the stage because it's entertaining and because it also seems to be true. And second way is to say I am not on the stage at all. I am accidentally here. Actually, I'm making the stage. Yeah, like yeah, come on. Many artists today saying, I just give a platform, I just give a space, I just open the possibility. I am not here, I am like a stage itself. So that's two possibilities. And that is not what was earlier salvation is now a survival, I would say.
Questions in the meantime now? Please don't hesitate.
Take up the question of ethics and the subject. Could you elaborate how the self as design? Could you think that through for me in terms of ethics? Is it a self? Is it a something that is its own recompense? The act of self-representation or the self? Design, or is it addressed to another? Could you just elaborate that in terms of ethics?
Well, I almost would say that in a certain way, yeah, ethics, the act of aestheticization itself and self-aestheticization itself is always already an ethical act. Yeah. An ethical act in a way that if you show yourself to the audience, if you demonstrate yourself, your position, your ideas, and so to the public, you always take a risk. Yeah. You always take a risk and you all endanger your existence in this world. Because if you don't do that, then it's much more comfortable way of existence. So one asks oneself why people take this risk. It's not so necessarily, in fact. So I would say that at the bottom, it is an ethical gesture. It's an ethical gesture in a way that if you take this risk, and you present something to the audience, then you give this audience a possibility to develop a discourse that has some substance. Yeah? For example, just to take a very drastic example of what I have in mind, in Germany especially, there's a lot of discussion about Leni Riefenstahl and her movies. So how ethical it was for her, as it was said time and again, to submit herself to Nazi aesthetics. I was always kind of irritated by this question because what is actually Nazi aesthetics? If you ask people what is a Nazi aesthetic, they say, look at Leni Riefenstahl. Yeah, that is a Nazi aesthetic. So she does not submit herself to a Nazi aesthetics. She created a Nazi aesthetics. And it is a completely different way of looking at things, because if you would not have Leni Riefenstahl and maybe a couple other artists of the time, we wouldn't know what fascist aesthetic actually is, or Nazi aesthetic. How this kind of movement can appear, has to appear, if it appeared in the world. So we have maybe two level of ethics. Yeah, one is general human decency, yeah, that is of course very, very important in this case. But there is a specific artistic honesty of being able and taking decision to show something at your own risk. It's two kind of ethics that maybe contradict each other, but it happens.
Thank you. But what is being disclosed? What is being disclosed in that moment of disclosure? That's still not clear. I mean, is it an unconscious cause that comes transgenerationally? What is actually being disclosed? Is it something... Do you understand what I'm asking?
Something is disclosed, and the same thing is covered. Yeah? That is a problem of every kind of aestheticization. As I said, if we look, we can remain the same example of Leni Riefenstahl. It is a disclosure of what a Nazi movement, Nazi aesthetic is. Yeah? The attitude that lies behind a very fundamental intention and actions of National Socialism, not only political surface, but kind of very substantial self-positioning in the world. At the same time, we can argue, people argued, and they have right, that her movies also cover something in the National Socialism. So you cannot present something without at the same time concealing what you actually shows. But if you show something, you give it to other person a chance to ask questions, to go further, to find something behind the facade, to ask further questions. So you open at your own risk, yeah? You open a kind of investigation and you open a kind of inquiry that would be not possible in a case that everything would remain obscure and everything would remain non-shown and non-existent. That is why I would say that this kind of ethics is always very ambivalent, but at the same time, I don't believe that art of 20th century in its more radical manifestation could exist without practicing this kind of ethics.
Okay. Oh, there's a question here.
So, fundamental question. Who designed the artist? Is it the god or the curator?
Well...
To be or not to be?
It's a difficult question because, first of all, curator always tries to design artist, and he does not, he can't escape to do so, yeah? Because if you make an exhibition, you create a context, you create a setting, you put the works of certain artists, this is that position, and that, of course, ascribes to this work a certain meaning, and this positioning of the artist is unescapable, what curator is doing every time. So, of course, curator is designing cars. At the same time, there are a lot of curators, yeah, that designing cars everybody in a very different way. So if you look at the itinerary of a contemporary artist, you see a chain of different stages, different installations, different projects, different different curatorial decisions, and the artist emerges from this chain as somebody who is represented by curator at the same time not. Yeah. The same thing is with the media. Of course, God is media today. Yeah. So the media also presents artists as celebrity, but presents it a very different way. So that we get an arrangement of very heterogeneous projects, heterogeneous images, heterogeneous interpretations. The artist remains somebody who is covered at the same time not. Yeah? It's the same ambivalence that in the case I just discussed before. Yeah, so we can say yes, we can say no. Yeah.
There's one more question here and another one here. Suddenly they come.
Hi, can you probably talk about the relationship between the aesthetics or the ornament, ornamentation and the emotion or seduction?
Yes, of course, ornamentation is always connected to emotions. To seduction. And that's why Loos and Malevich and Rodchenko and Mondrian, many other representatives of the avant-garde didn't like ornament. Yeah? They didn't like ornament because they didn't want to seduce. They didn't want to have, you know, express any emotions. They wanted to free the individual and to give to the individual something like a godlike, unemotional, maybe Christian, maybe Buddhistic, a neutral attitude, yeah, attitude of a pure contemplation. I think very important for the avant-garde was this kind of ideal of self-purification and salvation, as it was said, but salvation from what? Salvation actually from seduction and emotions. Now, if you look at contemporary art, then we see that a certain kind of return of ornament. But as I said, it's an ornament of catastrophe. So the emotion that actually is transported by this ornament, if it is really successful and if it is recognized as being relevant, is always at the same time a collapse of any emotion and collapse of any seduction. It's something that is there as image, as it's there as a decoration maybe, but it's decorations that collapses every decoration and deconstruct and destruct every possibility of seduction. It was all already a strategy of the 20s and beginning of the 30s, and it seems to me that in many respects what we see now is a return of this late stage of the avant-garde, of the period immediately after avant-garde.
I would like to ask you to elaborate a little bit about your notion of self and the real.
Which notion?
And the idea of self, because like if you look at Loos or Simmel, for instance, in the early modernity, there's the idea that the self needs to be protected, that there is an authentic self, and you have to present this kind of neutral facade to protect it. And even if you look at people like de Boer, certainly, and Baudrillard, there's still the notion that there is some kind of authenticity behind the design, so to speak. So my question is, all this self-design going on, do you believe that there isn't actually some kind of truth? Is the self only on the surface, or do you still sort of retain the idea that there is some kind of authentic self behind it? And that also links to the idea of the real, where, oh, if you get what I mean.
Well, you know, if you say that there is a self and that is a real behind the surface, then it is, of course, a metaphysical assertion that has no value, that has no substance, No question about that. It was deconstructed 100 times, and we are living after the deconstruction, of course. Now, but if we say that behind the surface there is no self, it's also a kind of metaphysical assertion, because we also don't know that. So what we have to do, if we look at something, it's a play of conjectures. Yeah, maybe yes, maybe no, maybe there is a self, maybe not. And in any case, we of course don't believe in authenticity, we don't believe in God, but in a very interesting way, we still believe in Satan, in devil. Yeah, we don't believe in God, and we don't believe in good, but we believe in the possibility of evil. That means we believe in the possibility of the surface to crack and form, not only to be deconstructed theoretically, but really to be, really to decay, and really to be fragmented, really to disappear. And I think that is what our imagination associates with the inner possibility of the things, is a possibility of their disappearance. Possibility of their not only destruction, but deconstruction, but destruction, including ultimate destruction. So we always have this kind of apocalyptic conspiracy theory, as I said. So we always keep in mind the possibility that the thing just disappear, and disappear completely or partially. And I think that is what people associate with the concept of real and the concept of self. Yeah? It's a kind of possibility of explosion, a possibility of decay. It is nobody that can avoid this possibility, and no metaphysical, be it positive metaphysical or negative metaphysical reasoning, can erase this possibility.
One more question here.
So couldn't we just the same way say that this new attempt to ornament, this new race of ornaments now is an attempt to go against over-rationalization?
Yes. It goes deeper. Yeah? I mean, what I try to say is that there is a design of disappearance. There is a design of self-suicide, for example, in other cultures. There is a design of disappearance. There is a design of sacrifice. There is design of decline, of decay. There is an interesting fact that for a very long time, the discourse of secularization functioned in a way that people said, there is no God, there is no soul, so everything is mortal. Nothing remains beyond death. But in fact, something remains beyond death, that is corpse in any case. Yeah? So there is a possibility of decay, the possibility of destruction, the possibility of disappearance is something that earlier was seen as just happening. And now our design, our most interesting design, is precisely design of destruction and disappearance. If you look at the movies, mainstream American Hollywood movies, what they're actually doing, they're doing the design of destruction. Yeah, look at Dark Knight here, for example. Yeah, it's a design of destruction, and it's design of the self-destruction, and so on and so on. Yeah? So after this period of avant-garde, after the period of neutrality, there is no way back to emotion and reappearance of traditional design. I think what happens now is the emergence of new design is design of nothingness and destruction.
One more question.
Okay. Hello. One thing I haven't heard you talking about at all is the notion of the tribal in design, because of course if you have a design self, quite often what it expresses is a sense of belonging to something larger than yourself, and in fact it's in many ways the manifestation of a collective identity, which you could perhaps equate with the modern kind of religion. In the same way that religions don't necessarily aesthetically, ethically distinguish one another, but distinguish one another by practice and ritual. So this is perhaps not an ethical decision in the design of the self, but simply a tribal one.
And that's true. At the same time, I think Lawes has right. Lawes has right that the modernity is a time in which this commitment to the tribe, in whatever sense, so commitment to religion, commitment to certain class, societal class, and so on, this commitment decreases and disappears. So at the end, we do not accept this kind of this kind of explanation. If somebody comes to us and says, "Well, that's why I am from this tribe, yeah? And that's why I look like that." Then what we actually think about him, we think he uses his tribal origin as a kind of ready-made, yeah? As a kind of ready-made that he now exhibits under completely different conditions and a completely different modern scene. That is also possible, to invent your identities and to take your identities and so on, and then bring them in completely different contexts. But we should be aware of a break between original modes of existence where these tribal forms were really necessarily imposed on us by history and tradition, and a situation of contemporary life where we mostly choose this this relics of the past to present ourselves to the outer world, and this decision to do so in that way is an ethical one, it's an aesthetical one, in any case it's an individual one. So I agree with Lawes on this point.
I would say thank you very much for your attention, for coming, for your interest, and thank you very much for his voice.